Let's call this meeting of the House Judiciary Committee to order. It is 1:22 p.m. on Friday, May 3rd, 2019. Before we begin, I want to thank Robert Montenegro, the House Judiciary Secretary, who makes sure we have a transcript of our meetings, and Madison Truitt from the Juneau LIO, who makes sure we have sound. At this time, I want to remind committee members and all those in the room to please silence your cell phones. Present today, we have Representative Wool, Representative Shaw, Representative Stutes, and myself, Representative Clayman. We have a quorum to conduct business. Our first order of business today is House Bill 123, Electric-Assisted Bicycles, sponsored by Representative Wool. This is the first hearing of the bill in the House Judiciary Committee. Here to introduce the bill is Representative Wool and his staff, Ann Ritgers. Please come forward and identify yourselves for the record, and then you may begin your remarks. And I would ask committee members to do your best to save your questions until after they finish their opening remarks. I know that Representative Wool thinks he has a higher duty to go to the Finance Committee at about 1:30, so we're going to get him started and recognize he will leave us shortly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Representative Adam Wool, representing District 5 in Fairbanks, and with me is my staffer, Ann Ritgers, who's been working on this bill with me for this session. I want to thank the committee members for hearing this bill and also for putting it at the top of the list today, since I do have another bill up in finance momentarily. I'll sort of give you a brief overview of the intent of the bill, and then Ann can go through all the graphics and language of the bill as needed. But the impetus for this bill was I had a constituent who was riding an electric-assisted bicycle and got pulled over and told that because he didn't have a driver's license, he wasn't able to ride this type of bicycle. So we looked into what the law requires, and certain types, they define motorized bicycles, motorized vehicles in statute, but they don't define electric-assisted bicycles, which are becoming more and more popular all the time. What this bill does is define electric-assisted bicycles, what they are, and what you need to ride them, which is basically we want to treat electric-assisted bicycles the same as bicycles. So you don't need a license. You don't need to register them. Helmets are not mandatory. And basically want to treat them like bicycles. However, a local municipality can enforce different rules for electric bikes than regular bikes, and they have that discretion in this bill. But on a statewide basis, these electric-assisted bicycles will be treated like bicycles. And if there's any questions, we can answer those, and we can Ms. Ritgers can go over the bill, and we have a slideshow with it.
For the record, Ann Ritgers, staff to Representative Wool, and we have a brief slideshow about the bill.
And I recognize that Representative Ledoux has joined us.
So as the representative just said, the objective of House Bill 123 is to regulate electric-assisted bicycles as bicycles, update statute to reflect these new technologies, and really to bring clarity for bicycle riders and retailers in Alaska on these kind of bike laws.
And I apologize, Representative Eastman, I didn't recognize your arrival a few minutes ago, who arrived before Representative Ledoux. Please continue.
The meat of our bill is in Section 8, which is the definition of an electric-assisted bicycle. And that definition is a bicycle that is designed to travel with not more than three wheels in contact with the ground. It has fully operative pedals for human propulsion, and has an electric motor that has a power output of not more than 750 watts, which is also one horsepower, provides assistance only when the rider is pedaling, and ceases to provide assistance to the rider when the bicycle reaches a speed of 28 miles an hour. This is a map that shows that 36 states across the U.S. have some type of e-bike definition in their statute. As you can see, Alaska is not one of those states. You may have seen an e-bike or two around Juneau or around the community that you're from. A lot of them look like this, with a battery pack mounted on that mid-frame, the motor down in the hub. And I also pointed out that the fully operative pedals are on all e-bikes. Not all e-bikes have a motor that's fairly obvious. A lot of them have the motor and the battery encased in the frame, and so they might look like a regular bike going down the road. And it's an important distinction that we aren't talking about electric scooters or mopeds in this. As you can see, they don't have fully operative pedals. There's no pedal assist, and they have larger gas engines. And that concludes our presentation.
Questions for the bill sponsor or his staff? Representative Shaw.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a couple of questions. One, you make note of 28 miles an hour maximum speed, but on page 3, line 26 of the bill says of maximum speed of not more than 15 miles an hour. Can you differentiate between the two of those conflicting speeds?
I'm sorry, what line was that on
that
page 3?
That was line 26 of page 3.
So on that line, through the chair, Representative Shaw, starting on line 23, that's the definition of an electric personal motor vehicle, which is not the definition of the electric assisted bicycle. So that definition is talking about a completely different vehicle.
Yes, thank you. More than anything else, I just want to make people aware that there were two definitions, and I wanted to hear that from the sponsor. Thank you.
Follow-up?
No follow-up. Thank you.
I had actually a question about the same section, statute, section 12, section 5 of the bill. Is that describing a golf cart or some other kind of electric propelled vehicle?
Mr. Chairman, we deduced that was referring to a Segway, a two-wheeled personal non-tandem wheel vehicle.
Okay. Thank you. That was the first thought, and thought it was a golf cart. Representative Ledoux.
Is there any regulation now for electric assisted bicycles?
They really fall into a gray area because they don't fit any current definitions of vehicle in Alaska statute. So the purpose of this bill is to clearly define them so everyone understands exactly what they are.
Follow up?
Representative Ledoux.
So what's the problem that we're actually trying to fix here?
Representative Ledoux, through the chair, as I said earlier, and I'm not sure you were here, but I had a constituent who was pulled over riding an electric bicycle. This individual did not have a driver's license. It had been revoked. So that was the way he was commuting. And he was told he couldn't ride this motorized vehicle. And there are laws for motorized vehicles that generally describe a 50cc gas motor or bigger, and electric motors aren't really defined. This is defining them in statute and saying what is a electric bike, because there are electric bikes that, for example, don't require pedal assist, and we're not including those. So if you don't have to pedal, then we're not calling those e-bikes in state law. So we're basically just defining these as electric bicycles treated like a bicycle. No helmet, no registration, no license.
Follow-up, Representative Ledoux.
So you're actually excluding them from regulations rather than kind of regulating them, right?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, we're defining them as a class of bicycle, not to be confused with scooters or these little... a lot of cities right now are dealing with this problem of not scooters, they're you stand on them and they
mean the motorized skateboards?
Yeah, skateboards. Like no, there's another one that they have that you stand up with a, it's not quite, I can't remember the name, but they're all over. Some cities are just all over the place, and they're a problem. They're a motorized vehicle, but they're not pedal assist. So it's a definition statute defining what this is.
Thank you.
And on the sort of similar, the top speed in the statute would say 28 miles an hour. What happens if 5 years from now the industry making e-bikes decides that the standard's going to go up to 30 miles an hour? Do they all then become motorized vehicles?
Mr. Chair, there actually are a couple different classifications of pedal-assisted e-bikes. Some of them, the assist stops at 20, and some they go up to 28, and after 28 miles per hour, the assist function stops. You're just pedaling on your own. If there were to be another generation of these vehicles, say, that went up to 35 with pedal assist, if this statute, if this bill were to become law, those ones that go faster would fall under a motorized vehicle category where helmets registration and operator's license may come into effect according to state law.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you. I'm curious, so what would be the impact, or what do you anticipate the impact, if this were to pass and your same constituent were to be pulled over again? What's going to change?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman. Well, if the police officer was aware of this definition of e-bike and this person was riding an electric bicycle that fits our definition, he would not have to have a driver's license. So if he lost his license, he could still ride this bicycle on roads just like bicycles can.
And follow-up?
Representative Eastman.
Thank you, through the chair. And so have we given discretion to traffic officers to make those kind of pullovers currently? I mean, it sounded to me like you were saying we've given some authority for pulling over 50 cc's, but since this isn't 50 cc's, I mean, would if we haven't given that discretion, shouldn't the response just be, you know, this isn't a vehicle?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, I think there's just confusion maybe, or, you know, maybe the officers think that because it's motorized, it falls under the motorized vehicle definition, because right now it does deal with 50 cc's, but it doesn't really talk about electric motors. And so what we're doing is we're putting 750 watts as the maximum size, which is about one horsepower. I don't know what the horsepower of 50 cc's is. It's probably more than that. But we are making it clear that this is an e-bike and it's to not be regulated like a motorized vehicle.
And follow-up?
Representative Eastman.
I'm also through the chair. So now I'm trying to take the perspective of the police officer. How do I know something 750 versus 500 versus 1,500? Is there any kind of visual cue that gives me, you know, I don't have to stop that guy because it's, you know, it's not a vehicle?
Yeah. Through the chair, Representative Eastman, I'm not sure I have a definitive answer to that, but if it was, if 750 watts, which is one horsepower, which you saw some of those graphics, they kind of look like bikes, they pedal like bikes. If the motor was, say, 2,000 watts, the vehicle would probably be going a lot faster, and it would be bigger and heavier. I know that some of these have the information stamped on them somewhere, but I can't speak to all of them. I guess if they thought someone was really speeding on one of these e-bikes, they may pull them over and look into it further. But most of them it looks like a bike. It smells like a bike. It is a bike.
Thank you. And final follow-up?
Representative Eastman.
Thank you. Follow-up. So I'm curious also, is there, once this bill passes, is there a speed limit for e-bikes?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman. No, they're treated like bicycles. To the effect, there's no speed limit for a bicycle. If someone riding a bicycle down a hill hits 45 miles an hour, that's legal. They probably should wear a helmet, but it's not required by state law. Same would be for e-bikes.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Representative Ledoux.
So what happened to this constituent's case?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, I don't know. I think he was forced to walk home. I'll follow up on it. But he reached out to me and explained the situation where he was told he couldn't ride this bicycle without a license. And I didn't follow up to find out exactly what happened, but I will.
So. Follow up. So I guess what I'm trying to figure out is this a matter of something that we need to actually have a statute about, or should police just be simply educated that if something looks like a bike and rides like a bike and squeaks like a bike, that it's a bike and that you don't have to have a driver's license for it?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, that would be great if that were the case. As you saw from the graphic earlier, a majority of states do have statutes defining e-bikes, and I think it's for the reason to eliminate confusion about what is a motorized vehicle. And this clearly defines in statute what is a electric motorized bicycle. If it's a bigger motor, if it goes faster, if it doesn't require pedaling assist, but some of them don't. They look the same, but you just hit a throttle and you can go. So it's really about defining what it is to clarify it, because we don't have electric bikes, and they're becoming more and more popular all the time. And I think we have some testifiers today. And unfortunately, I at this point have to run upstairs and testify on another bill. But
all right, well, Representative, well, thank you for joining us today. And further questions for the staff? Hearing and seeing no further questions, I would note that Marla Thompson, the director of the Department of Motor Vehicles, is available online. Nancy Mead from the court system is also here. But what I'd like to do now is open up for public testimony on House Bill 123. And if you were on the phone, let's see. Oh, it looks like we've got.
Is there anybody from the Department of Law here?
There is somebody from the Department of Law on the phone. But let's get to public testimony, and then we'll get to the questions. First up, looks like at the Anchorage LIO, Carrie Shiflia. Can you hear us?
Yes, sir.
Please state your name. We limit public testimony to 2 minutes, but you can proceed.
My name is Carrie Shifley. I'm calling in as an individual, although I am an owner of an electric bike store. I am calling in as an individual. I've been riding electric bikes since 2012 and have found that they allow me to get out and ride much more than I typically would. I think it's important to clarify the state law. As Representative Wohl mentioned, currently everyone wants to push it into a motorized classification with a 50cc. That will not hold up in court. It declares a cubic centimeter displacement value. Electric motors do not have that. I think it would be wise to align the electric bike law with the municipality of Anchorage's electric bike law, which is what this state law does, House Bill 123. It also aligns with the federal definition of what an electric bike is through the Consumer Product Safety Act. So I think it's smart to have our definitions in line with federal and the largest municipality or most populous municipality in Alaska. How do you define what is what? An industry standard that was enacted in 2016 is that the bikes will be stamped with a class 1, 2, or 3 number on there. And essentially all of the industry is building bikes 90% to the 20-mile-an-hour limit. Some are going to 28-mile-an-hour, but that's a very limited amount, and even smaller fraction that go faster than 28-mile-an-hour, which I think is an important distinction. If they go faster than 28-mile-an-hour or have a larger motor than what we deem fit, they should be classified as motorized, and if they're under those limits, they should be classified as non-motorized and be limited to or be allowed wherever bicycles are allowed. And other than that, I thank you for your time and appreciate the public comment.
Thank you very much. We also have, looks like, on the Anchorage LIO, William Harrington. Mr. Harrington, please state your name and you can
proceed. Thank you, Chairman, and members of the committee. This is an interesting topic, and these electrical vehicles of all type are just really going gangs. I would replace the word bicycle with personal wheeled electric vehicle, a PWEV. The reason for this is you do have those electric skateboards, which are becoming much more popular. You do have electric scooters. I'm 70 years old, and I'm looking to buy a three-wheel electric scooter just to get around town. You might call it just a stripped-down go-kart or a stripped-down electric golf cart. The electric bikes are not the same as pedal bikes, as a rowboat is not the same as a speedboat. Personal injury can only be worse in an accident when a helmet is not worn. Helmets should be required for use. How many tragic accidents will be necessary before you legislate safety upgrades? Back to scooters, Lime and Bird, a couple of companies that have inundated Portland, Seattle, SFO, and littered them across the streets. I think there was a bunch thrown in a pile and burnt down there in Venice Beach, California. We need to include them in this argument. We need to include them in this discussion. They're not going away. They're going to become a lot more popular. And to ignore them is, you'll be back on this subject over and over and over. So the other good point of all this is I do believe that these electric bikes should be licensed, registered, and have a title, a state title. And that as a valuable property, like any valuable property, you exchange it when you exchange titles. This will be good for the tax man, and I'm sure that the city of Anchorage can find another way to grab a few bucks out of the people. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I don't see anyone else online for public testimony, representative, so I'm going to close public. Actually, is there anyone in the room that would like to provide testimony about House Bill 123 about electric bicycles? Hearing and seeing none, the public hearing is closed. Representative Ledoux, I think you had a question for the representative from the Department of Law. Mr. Higgins, are you on the line? Kevin Higgins, can you hear us?
From the Department of Law.
Yeah, Mr. Higgins, Representative Ledoux has a question. Go ahead, Representative Ledoux.
So actually, I've got two questions. So my first question is, without this law, should police be stopping people on these electric bikes?
That's a much more complicated question than just yes or no. It would have to depend on circumstances of the interaction between the officer and the person riding the bike.
I guess I don't understand that. Either it's considered a motor vehicle under state law or it's not considered a motor vehicle, regardless of what sort of interaction there is between the person and the police officer.
Representative Ledoux, through the chair, I think part of the problem stems from the fact that e-bikes currently aren't defined, so they are under one section motor vehicles, under another section motorcycles, under another section motor-driven cycles. They're not bicycles under regulation. They're not off-highway vehicles. The term motorized bicycle appears in some public safety regulations, but that term isn't ever defined. So as it currently stands, it seems like they must be registered and that they must be insured.
So this bill is actually necessary to clarify whether they're supposed to be stopped or not, right?
I'm sorry, Representative Ledoux, through the chair, I do believe that this bill would help provide some clarification, and I think one of the other important sections, I know that the sponsor referenced Section 8, but Section 3 is also very important because it allows municipalities to implement regulations, because the limitation on the regulation, looking on page 2, lines 10 through 13 in particular, the limitation on regulation of electric-assisted bicycles here do not apply to municipal ordinances regulating those things. So it would be helpful to define that in state law, but also then to allow the municipalities to develop their own regulations and to then have their local law enforcement understand how to enforce those, just like any other traffic safety or public safety measure.
Follow up?
Representative Ledoux.
So I thought that the municipality of Anchorage already has regulations. So how do they have regulations if we need this statute in order to let them have regulations?
Representative Ledoux, through the chair, I believe that first, I'm not entirely clear on what Anchorage's regulations are, but I do know that it makes it explicit that that the state regulations could not prohibit the use of an electric-assisted bicycle, but this limitation would not apply to municipal regulation. I hope that was clear.
Sort of. So, one more thing. With respect to motorcycles, do we require people on motorcycles to wear helmets? Is that in our law right now?
Under, I believe if you're over 18, you are not required to wear a helmet, but I'm getting that answer quickly here.
And follow up?
Representative Ledoux.
And are there any rules about bicycle helmets under state law?
Not under state law.
Thank you.
Any other questions, either for the Department of Law representative, for Marla Thompson from the Division of Motor Vehicles, or from Nancy Mead, the General Counsel for the court system? Hearing and seeing none, we're going to move on to our next bill. I would note with regard to House Bill 123, we will be holding the bill, but if you would like to offer an amendment for House Bill 123, those amendments will be due on Tuesday, May 7th at 5 p.m. Again, Tuesday, May 7th at 5 p.m. I would encourage you to get your amendments in a timely way. And that will bring us to our next order of business. But before we do that, we're going to take a very brief at ease. Back on record. Our second order of business today is House Joint Resolution 18, Constitutional Amendment, Permanent Fund, Percent of Market Value Earnings, sponsored by Representative Christ Tompkins. This is the first hearing of the bill in the Judiciary Committee. Here to introduce the bill is Representative Christ Tompkins and his staff, Kevin McGowan. Please come forward, identify yourself for the record, and you may begin your remarks. I'd ask committee members to please save your questions for after they finish with their remarks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Jonathan Christ Tompkins, District 35. House Joint Resolution 18 does two things. It rolls the earnings reserve account into the principal so that the entirety of the Alaska Permanent Fund is constitutionally protected. And it provides for a 5% of market value draw from that new combined, fully constitutionally protected permanent fund every year that cannot be broken and cannot be overdrawn by the legislature. That's House Joint Resolution 18. And actually, I'll pass to Mr. McGowan on my staff.
For the record, Kevin McGowan, staff to Representative Christ Tompkins. Through the chair, I think it's worth noting really quick that the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation has put out, to my knowledge, four resolutions that mention the support for a constitutionalized POMB, including Resolution 0013, 0305, 0409, and 1804. And to quote from Resolution 0409, now therefore be it resolved by the Board of Trustees that the Board reaffirms its commitment to a constitutional amendment that provides for protection of the fund by application of a POMB payout mechanism.
Questions for the resolution sponsor? Representative Eastman.
Thank you. Through the chair. Well, I guess the first question is, why the amendment?
Representative Eastman, through the chair, two different reasons fundamentally, one of which, as it happens, was kind of discussed on the House floor today and the Senate proposing to transfer 12, or if you count inflation proofing, $13 billion from the area to the corpus. And sort of independent of the budgets the legislature passes, with the current structure of the permanent fund, there's always the risk that if we hit a really rough patch in the economy or the markets and the ERA dramatically contracts, which the ERA can do whenever you have market volatility, it's possible that the ERA can hit zero. And as I think some members of the legislature are familiar, that almost happened during the Great Recession. It didn't quite happen, but we came actually very, very close to bottoming out the ERA, which at the time would have meant the inability to fully distribute dividends. Under SB 26, that would mean the inability to distribute dividends and or pay for certain public services. So that's the first piece, and it sort of resolves that from my perspective, sort of unnecessary risk of having an account that's very volatile and just kind of hoping that we have enough shock absorption in that account to survive any market downturns. So that would be the first reason. And then the second reason, which relates to the constitutional POMV, is basically saying, as a matter of policy, we, the legislature, resolve never to draw more than a sustainable amount from the permanent fund. We're never going to draw an unsustainable amount out of the permanent fund. And 5% is effectively 5% or less. You don't have to go up to 5%. The legislature could draw 4.8 or whatever if it wants to spend less money, which isn't necessarily a bad thing. But you can never go over that 5% cap, and therefore the permanent fund will forever be protected.
Follow up?
Representative Eastman.
Thank you. And so what do you anticipate the impact of this amendment would be to the dividend?
Representative Eastman, through the chair, I don't think there is not a direct impact on the dividend. The dividend isn't mentioned in this constitutional amendment. And I think it's important to sort of think about the indirect impacts. And I don't mean to pretend that there aren't, because when we're talking about the permanent fund and we talk about the state budget, everything is interconnected. And that's true with HJR 18. Ultimately, it leaves the question with the legislature what dividend should be. And the legislature, if it were the will of the legislature, if HJR 18 passed and were ratified by voters, the legislature could continue to pay out the full $3,000, at least at present year, dividend by present statute if it wanted to. That's $1.9 billion or so, I think, this year. And the 5% POMV this year is about $2.9 billion. So there's nothing that precludes that. And this amendment, from my perspective, very intentionally doesn't go into the dividend question. And I honestly have no intent to promote a dividend of a certain size through this amendment. My primary concern is if the permanent fund isn't fully constitutionally protected forever, then there might not be dividends in 10 or 20 or 30 years.
Thank you.
Other questions for the sponsor of House Joint Resolution 18? Hearing and seeing none, I would note that online, if questions are here, Emily Nauman from Ledge Legal is online. And I think if needed, we could probably get Alexi Painter and Pauline Swanson, Communications Director from the Permanent Fund Corporation, and Alexi Painter is with Ledge Finance. We could probably get them online if there are questions for them, but it doesn't seem like there are. So I'm going to open public testimony on HJR 18. I don't see anyone on the screen here that wants to testify. Is there anyone in the room that would like to testify on HJR 18? Hearing and seeing no one, the public hearing is closed. And that brings the bill back before the committee. It is my plan to actually move this bill from committee today, so I'm going to give members one final comment.
I have a question.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you. So I was just looking at Section 30 through the chair, and I'm seeing here that on line 8 that
– Section 3 of the bill, okay.
Section 30 referenced in the bill. It's in Section 3 of the bill. Okay. And I see here on line 8 of the bill that it's going to take – looks like all of the unencumbered balance of the fund that pays dividends, and it's going to put that in the corpus. So now what's the thought behind that?
Representative Price Tompkins or your staff, we'll go back to questions.
Thank you.
Representative Eastman, through the chair, I'll be sure to let Mr. McGowan or perhaps Alexi Painter speak to this if I'm sort of superficially answering the question, but just if I'm reading that section right and its relation to what the constitutional amendment does, is that would effectively roll the earnings reserve account into the principal of the permanent fund, which was the first of the two functions of this that I mentioned initially. I think it's worth mentioning for good or bad, and I'm kind of genuinely of mixed minds of this, that this wouldn't take effect until, after the next general election. So the fiscal year ending June 30th, 2022, as Kevin just helpfully pointed out. So there would be a period of time in which the fund would remain as presently structured, future legislative sessions and operating budgets in which, were it the will or the wisdom of the legislature, money could be transferred from the earnings reserve account to the principal or the earnings reserve account to wherever, as is presently the case. But the answer to the question is it merges the earnings reserve account into the principal of the permanent fund.
And follow-up?
Representative Eastman.
Thank you. Through the chair. So if this goes through, so currently I think there's about $18.4 billion in that account. So if that account effectively goes to zero because it's put in the corpus and you have a bad year, which occasionally happens, and you're not, you know, earning that amount back over the course of the year, and you have this cap on what can come out of the corpus, I'm just curious, in a year like this year, if we were to keep our same level state operating budget unchanged, wouldn't that kind of mathematically have the effect of reducing that dividend down to about $1,000 or less, just by virtue of you've capped it and now you're paying the operating budget, and if you've paid the operating budget, there's less than the amount for a full dividend left to use for dividends? Did I get that right?
Representative Eastman, through the chair, I think there's two answers to that question. I mean, one is the sort of political reality answer to the question. The other is the mechanical.
Mm-hmm. Please.
Answer to the question. Mechanically, the answer is no. This does nothing to affect the size, big or small, of the dividend. I think in the premise that you posed in your question, that assumes that the operating budget stays unchanged, and that's really a question of what the 60 of us in this building do, or really what the people Alaskans elect to come to this building want. Certainly the governor, he would see that scenario differently, that you have a $3,000 dividend and then state services sort of get crunched after that. And that's sort of his series of operations. I mean, my own personal perspective, I'm only 1/60th of the legislature, is that you try to strike a balance between the two. But effectively, nothing changes from present. Right now, the legislature is figuring out how much money goes to dividends, how much money goes to state services. If this constitutional amendment were to pass, it means that the legislature can't take an unsustainable amount of money out of the permanent fund for any reason. That reason could be dividends. That reason could be state services. It could be that, say, the hot political idea of the day is we want to have a $2 billion capital budget, but we don't have the money to pay for it, gosh darn it. So let's just grab $2 billion out of the ERA because that's easy. That could be the reason. So it's agnostic the reason. It just says keep the permanent fund protected and don't take an unsustainable amount out of it.
Okay. And follow-up?
Representative Eastman.
Thank you. So so hearing what you're saying, I think I understand it, and correct me if I'm wrong. So currently the dividend historic calculation is based over a five-year average, but since we're now limiting it to a sustainable drawing, if you will, then if there is a down year, that 1 year would basically be the control over a money that's available to a dividend. So if it's a bad year, even if you've got good years on either side, you may have a very smaller or even no dividend at all. Is that kind of how that would work in a bad year?
This might be good for Lexi, although I'm not sure I fully tracked the question. Could you say that once more?
Yeah, so currently in statute, and I know we don't always follow it, but I'm just using that calculation. It's a five-year rolling average. And so no matter what happens in any one year, if there's, you know, really good or really bad, it sort of gets factored into the five-year rolling average. And so if this goes through and we're now only taking a sustainable draw on the year at which a dividend is issued, then I don't see us looking back to those, you know, averages at that point. I mean, even if we wanted to, because there literally wouldn't be the ability to draw that amount of money to pay the dividend. So if you have a bad year and you've paid your operating budget and there's not much left because it was a bad year, then you don't have the benefit of going back to those previous good years to have that fund available for a dividend. Even if there was the political will to have a higher dividend, you just mathematically couldn't do it.
I'm going to ask Alexi Painter to speak to this, because I just want to make
Great,
sure
thank
he's
you.
Absolutely right.
So Alexi Painter is here.
The first line says,
but,
the first 5 years of the preceding six fiscal years.
But if I may just briefly, Mr. Chair and Representative Smith through the chair, the HJR 18 looks at a five-year average, and also this amendment doesn't change the statutory formula for the dividend, so that remains a five-year average. So I'm not sure I understand the question, but I trust Alexi to understand this better than I do.
For the record, Alexi Painter, Legislative Finance Division, and through the chair, Representative Eastman, it's theoretically possible that the dividend calculation would exceed the five-year moving average of 5%. I think you would have to be stretching the bounds of realistic investment growth, so that you'd have so much realized income that the dividend formula exceeded that 5%. I think it'd be extremely difficult for the fund to grow that quickly that would happen, that the five-year average would be insufficient. So when we had bad years, for example, previously, that causes the dividend to decrease much more drastically than the moving average of the balance does. So if, for example, in the 2008-2009 recession, the dividend went down, the dividend calculation went down from about 1,800 to about 800, because that one really bad year brought the average down so far. But if we had based on the POMV calculation, the actual value of the fund went down by less than 20%, you know, even in that worst year. So there would still, the POMV draw would be more than adequate to pay for the dividend, even if there was a down year, because that dividend is going to be more volatile than your POMV will be. So bad market years shouldn't cause any issues with that, to my knowledge.
Follow-up?
Representative Eastman.
Thank you. All right, so just to make sure I understand, so say we have another year where, unfortunately, the permanent fund market crash, we don't have a positive return on the fund. It's just neutral. How much available, how much would there be available for, you know, payment of dividend at that point? And where could we as a legislature go to look for that money?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, are you referring to the current constitutional construct or the...
No, once this passes, I'm trying to get a feel for the impacts.
So, through the chair, Representative Eastman, in that scenario, if you had, say, this year we had no earnings, the five-year average balance would still be a positive number, the average of, you know, 5 years of around $60 billion a year. So you would still have a $3 billion allowable draw. And so even if your dividend calculation changed, that would be more than sufficient to pay that dividend based on that limit. So I guess if I'm understanding your question correctly, because the draw would be based on balances, not earnings, then small changes in earnings any changes in earnings shouldn't really affect the POMV draw very much.
Okay, can I ask a clarifying question?
Representative, I'm going to give you one last question, mm-hmm. and then I have a couple of questions, and this is your last question, and tell somebody else, because you may get clarity from the questions of others.
Very good. Thank you, and through the chair. So let's say we have, you know, a year like this year, other than we're not making any money because the market crashed. how much then is available to us as a legislature to spend on the budget, other things, and still, you know, draw a dividend from that amount. I mean, you mentioned $3 billion. I'm trying to incorporate that into, you were just talking about, you know, let's take this year as an example, other than we're not making any additional money from the earnings, so we don't have, you know, additional money coming from the fund.
Representative Eastman, through the chair. So under this bill, if it were in effect right now, even if the earnings currently were zero, the POMV draw would be based on balances through the end of FY18, so we could still spend that full POMV draw of $2.9 billion, and that, whether there's earnings or not, that's kind of the stability of a percent of market value draw, is that even if you have a downturn in earnings, there's still a balance available because there's still a $60 billion fund to draw from. So we would still have that $2.9 billion, regardless of whether there were earnings.
So that I fully understand what this amendment would do, were the voters to approve it, is it would essentially eliminate the earnings reserve account entirely, and earnings would just roll back into the fund all the time, and then every year you would look at the total value of the fund, and if there were $100 billion in the fund and the rate was 5% under the formula, then there would be $5 billion for the legislature to appropriate as it sees fit. And from that and other revenues, the legislature would have to decide how much of a dividend to pay, whether that be by formula or whether they determine that based on Supreme Court decisions, they don't have to pay it to the formula. They can just pay what they have the money to pay. But basically, the revenue, including the 5%, would be what revenue was available to spend.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. So they would, you know, if the earnings amount would not be the controlling factor, it'd be what that percent of market value calculation would be.
Now, there's a couple of other accounts. There's the Constitutional Budget Reserve account, and I think the Statutory Budget Reserve account. Do those get counted into the percent of market value calculation, or would the draw only relate to the funds in the permanent fund?
Mr. Chairman, it would only be the balances in the permanent fund.
Am I correct that at least today when they calculate the percent of market value, they actually include the amounts in some of those other funds that the permanent fund is managing?
No, the Senate Bill 26 specifically excludes the Mental Health Trust money and others that are managed by the permanent fund.
Okay. From the calculation.
Correct.
Anybody have other questions? All right. We're going to take anybody. Well, let's take a brief at ease. I'm going to give folks, everybody that wants one chance to make final comments, and then we'll entertain a motion to move the bill from the committee. Anyone want to make comments? Representative Ledoux.
I think we heard this in State Affairs the other day, and I'm just uncomfortable about moving anything or dealing with anything relating to permanent fund bills until we determine the elephant in the closet, which is the size of the dividend. So I don't support this.
Representative Eastman.
No, thank you. It seems to me that this is sort of trying to enshrine something similar to what the House has pursued as far as budget strategy this session, and it sort of leaves out what the amount of the dividend will be until everything else has been decided, and that's concerning to me, because that's putting it at the lowest priority of our spending priorities, and my constituents believe that it should be a pretty high priority.
Thank you, Representative Eastman. Any comments, Representative Stutz, Representative Shaw? May I have a motion? Representative Stutz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Be happy to make a motion. I move version 31-LS0308/S of HJR 18 with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Is there an objection? There's an objection. Will you please call the roll?
Representative Ledoux?
No.
Representative Wool, not present. Representative Eastman?
No.
Representative Shaw?
Yes.
Representative Kopp, not present. Representative Stutes?
Yes.
Chair Klayman?
Yes.
Mr. Chair, there's 3 yeas, 2 nays.
So by a vote of 3 yeas and 2 nays, House Joint Resolution 18 passes from the committee. I would ask members of the committee that are here to please sign the paperwork as we move on to the third item on the calendar today. Our third order of business today is House Bill 110, Vehicles and Boats Transfer on Death of Title, sponsored by Representative Sponholz. This is the first hearing of the bill in the Judiciary Committee. Here to introduce the bill is Representative Sponholz and her staff, Megan Holland. If you could both please come forward, identify yourselves for the record, and then you may begin your remarks. I would ask committee members to please save your questions for after they finish their opening remarks. And looks like we lost Representative Sponholz somewhere between 10 minutes ago and now. But go ahead, Ms. Holland. Identify yourself and proceed.
Where did that bill go next?
Finance.
For the record, my name is Megan Holland, staff to Representative Ivy Sponholz, bill sponsor to House Bill 110. Rep Sponholz should be here in just a few minutes to give her opening remarks for the legislation. But in the meantime, I can begin the presentation.
Go for it.
Before I begin, I would like to note that we should have Sandon Fisher, the bill drafter from Legislative Legal, online available for questions, and also the Division Director of the Department of Motor Vehicles as well for.
Right, she was here earlier, so she probably never left.
Yeah.
Looks like Kevin Higgins from Department of Law is also available. Go ahead.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Starting on slide 2 here, I'll just stop and let the bill sponsor, Rep. Sponholz, give her comments.
Representative Sponholz, welcome.
Welcome. Representative Ivy Sponholz for District 16 in East Anchorage. My apologies to the committee. I'm trying to be in three places at once this afternoon. So HB 110 builds on the work that has been done on the Uniform Real Property Transfer on Death Act that unanimously passed in both bodies in 2014 and created the Transfer on Death Deed. This bill is actually sort of the next generation of that. It was originally introduced by the late Representative Max Gruenberg in 2016. His bill created the Transfer on Death Deed transfers that concept to titles for vehicles. So it's fitting that we're here in the Max Gruenberg room. HB 110 is identical to the late Representative Gruenberg's legislation, with one exception being that we expand it to also include transfer on death titles for boats. We thought that that was important in the state of Alaska, where we have a lot of people own boats themselves. So if passed, Alaskans would be able to fill out a form at the DMV to designate up to 2 beneficiaries for their car or their vehicle. After their death, the beneficiaries would be able to provide proof of death to the DMV, fill out a form, pay associated fees, and receive a new title in their name. It adds another tool and the tool belt for estate planners, but it also streamlines and simplifies the estate planning process, which is nice for families to be able to avoid the time and the cost associated with estate planning and probate, so they can pass their assets down to their beneficiaries more quickly. It speeds up the process of these transfers as probate.
Representative Sponholz, I just got a note from my committee aide that all the other committees are taking a brief at ease so that we can all go attend the event involving missing Indigenous women.
Where I just was, yeah.
And if you don't have objection, we're going to go ahead and take an at ease so this committee can join that group as well. So we'll be at ease to the call of the chair. record. Appreciate that brief break, and I want to welcome Representative Kopp, who has survived an arduous outing in the House Resources Committee.
We're trading spots.
Representative Sponholz, please continue.
All right. So I might just start at the beginning for the purposes of continuity for Representative Kopp. So HB 110 creates a transfer on death deed that allows Alaskans to transfer their vehicles and boats upon their passing to their loved ones, avoiding probate using a simple deed. HB 110 is identical to a bill that was introduced by the late Representative Grunberg in 2016, which allowed for this to be done for vehicles. This bill adds the opportunity to also use this provision with boats. It passed the House in 2016, but then with the passing of Representative Grunberg, it didn't make it all the way across the finish line. And I've actually picked up this bill at the request of his widow, Kayla Epstein. If passed, Alaskans will be able to fill out a form at the DMV to designate up to two beneficiaries for their vehicle or their boat. And after their passing, the beneficiaries would be able to go to the DMV, provide proof of death, fill out a form and pay any associated fees, and receive the new title to that vehicle. This allows families to be able to bypass the probate process for a simple transfer of a vehicle or a boat, speeding up the transfer of assets and avoiding costly legal fees. The AARP and the Alaska Automobile Dealers Association and the Alaska Commission on Aging all support it. We've received no formal opposition to the bill, nor was there any opposition to Representative Grunberg's preceding bill, which was numbered 273 in 2016, for anybody's interest. So I'm happy to take any questions.
Actually, go ahead, Representative Stutz. I knew there was a presentation that we hadn't heard yet, but go ahead with the questions, Representative Stutz.
Thank you, and thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to make it real clear, it's a two-step process. So the first step is, if I'm the owner, I go and I say I want my boat and my car to go to my husband, Stormy, and then upon my dying, he goes in and fills out another form, correct?
Representative Stutz, through the chair, that is correct. It's like any other transfer of asset. The person who is bequeathing the asset has to indicate that they would like their asset to go to a certain beneficiary, and then the beneficiary has to say, yes, this person has passed, and I would like to secure that item now.
Thank you. Thank you.
Okay. Would you like to make your presentation?
Mm-hmm. One question. Isn't Representative Sponholz, isn't that a little bit different than a bank? If I've got a bank account and my say both my spouse is the first primary beneficiary and my kids are the contingent beneficiaries of that bank account, don't they just present death certificates and it transfers without any other action?
Representative Klayman, I believe that you have to present the certificate and then prove ID as well.
Sure.
We're saying the DMV is saying that they would like us to have a form that accompanies that to sort of document the process.
I see. Okay. Ms. Holland, you kept doing your best to stall on your presentation until Representative Sponholz arrived, but now you must proceed.
Thank you, Chair Klayman, members of the committee. For the record, again, my name is Megan Holland, staff to Representative Ivy Sponholz. Starting at slide two, Rep Sponholz already touched a little bit on the legislative history of this bill. But if you look at the graph on the right-hand side, you can see these are all the states that have passed the Uniform Real Property Transfer on Death Act, which we passed in Alaska in 2014. That created the transfer on death deed. It does say 2009 up there in the corner, but this is up to date. 2009 was just the year that the Uniform Law Commission approved of the legislation. I would like to note that in the United States, there are already 18 other states that have transfer on death titles for vehicles and 7 that have transfer on death titles for boats. So this is sort of a national trend that we're seeing across the country, following the spirit of the IRPTIDA Act. So, What's the problem that this legislation is solving? It is avoiding the costs and the time associated with probate when transferring your assets down to your beneficiaries. There are a few existing remedies in the state of Alaska already for transferring your assets down outside of the process of probate, but they do have some caveats. For example, you could have joint ownership with your vehicle, but then you have to forfeit your rights of ownership to some degree. We have you can file an affidavit for a collection of personal property, but there are limitations on that as well. The most limiting factor being that you can only use it when the value of all of your other assets is $50,000 or less. So while that may be a remedy available to some Alaskans, there would be most likely many who would not be able to take advantage of that if they wanted to pass their boat or their vehicle along outside of the process of probate. There's also the option of a living trust. However, these trusts are often much more complicated than wills and involve the use of involve using a lawyer, in which case you're still having to have some greater costs associated with passing those assets down, which is what we're trying to avoid here with this legislation. Again, just emphasizing previous comments of the bill's sponsor, this legislation creates transfer on death titles to reduce the need for probate in the state of Alaska, provide streamlined estate planning services at little cost to the state, and speed up the process of transferring property to beneficiaries. And I think I will just skip this slide because we addressed this already in a question from Representative Stutes, the process by which you would receive a transfer on death title. Now I'll briefly go through a sectional of the bill, if that's all right with committee members.
Go ahead.
Section one of the bill, this allows for owners of boats for which the Department of Administration issues titles to obtain a transfer on death title. I would like to note that there are boats exempt from titling requirements in the state of Alaska, and those are boats less than 24 feet long, boats already federally documented by the U.S. Coast Guard, foreign boats just passing through, as well as homemade imukaks, also, despite the fact that boats less than 24 feet long aren't required to receive titles in the state of Alaska, if you have a boat that is less than 24 feet, you are allowed to apply for a title at the DMV. There's a provision for that under AS 05-2506F that states that smaller boats can receive titles. So you would be, if you had a smaller boat, the transfer on death title would be available to you as well, despite the fact that there's an exemption. Section 2 of the bill adds transfer on death title transfers of boats and vehicles to the list of existing properties that can be transferred outside of the process of probate. Section 3 of the bill, this is the biggest section of the bill, and it's the meat of it. It creates the mechanism of transfer on death titles for boats and vehicles titled through the DMV. As you can see here on this slide, I've included an image of a mobile home that was on purpose. The DMV issues titles for some manufactured homes. These are homes that are at least in part transportable without a permanent foundation, that have plumbing, heating, and air conditioning, but not something that was permanently attached to the ground. I'd also like to note that a lot of the language from this section of the bill was taken directly from the Uniform Law Commission's language for the IRPTIDA Act that created the transfer on death deed. So a lot of that language is identical, with exception to sections that deal with other types of property where real language that was directed towards real estate wouldn't apply. We've already touched on how titles are obtained. How transfer on death titles would be changed or revoked is also through the DMV using a form. They could not be changed in any other manner. The legislation states that that's the only way you can revoke or change a title. Although if a vehicle or boat is sold, the transfer on death title would be revoked. For example, if I own a boat and Rep Sponholz is my beneficiary and I sell the boat to someone else, she will no longer be listed as the beneficiary for that boat, and the person who purchased my boat would get a clean title. This section of the bill also subjects transfer on death titles to the decedent's creditors, contracts, liens, and also lays out how liability will be enforced upon the transfer on death title. Similar to transfer on death deeds, the debt follows the asset. So when someone passes away and the boat or vehicle is given to the beneficiary, all of those debts and contracts will follow along with it. This section of the bill also lays out the rights of the owner and the beneficiaries. And that being that owners of transfer on death titles for boats and vehicles still have full rights of ownerships up until death. And also beneficiaries have the right to disclaim their interest in a boat or vehicle if they do not wish to receive it after the owner dies. Section 4 of the bill, this was a bit of a clarifying language here. We clarify that a person acting on behalf of the surviving spouse of a decedent may demand to enforce liability against the decedent's property. And this section of statute, that wasn't currently listed, so that was a fix put in there. Section 5 of the bill, this was a change that occurred in House State Affairs. It allows customers to authorize the Division of Motor Vehicles to automatically change their mailing address to match the address used by the United States Postal Service. With their consent. Many individuals, when they move from one mailing address to another, they change their address through USPS, but they fail to do so through DMV. This has resulted in the Department of Motor Vehicles receiving a high volume of returned mail, and they often have to send out multiple copies of the same document to multiple addresses. And this was an efficiency supported by the department.
Representative Kopp, go ahead.
So does the question for the sponsor, does the 1970s truck there going through Turnagain Pass reflect how long Representative Grunberg has been pushing on this bill? Had to ask.
Cop through the chair. I don't think so, but I actually wonder if that might be a Mustang.
No, it's got a big tarp in the back. It's got a bed to it. Was trying to figure out how long he'd been advocating for this.
My understanding, Representative Kopp through the chair, my understanding is that Representative Grunberg had been was very active in the Uniform Law Commission, the work that is done nationwide, particularly around contracts, and that he had only been working on this particular bill for a short period of time. But there was a preceding bill, actually in 2014, the Uniform Real Property Transfer on Death Act, URIPTA, which is real catchy there, that unanimously passed both bodies in 2014, that I believe that he worked on as well.
Sorry, that was Representative Kopp. That is Representative Grunberg's car in the picture.
It is.
but that wasn't how long ago this work started. You can continue now that we've gone down a rabbit hole.
For the record, Megan Holland, staff to Rep. Ivy Sponholz. I just looked for the picture that looked most Alaskan and had a car in it. Moving on to Section 6 of the bill, this section clearly states under statute related to vehicle titles that owners of vehicles for which the DMV issues titles may obtain a transfer on death title. Section 7 of the bill gives the Department of Administration authority to develop necessary regulations to implement transfer on death titles. Section 8 applies an immediate effective date to section, that should say Section 7, there's an immediate effective date for implementing regulations. And Section 9 of the bill applies an effective date of July 1st, 2020 to the rest of the bill. And with that, we are available to take your questions.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you, through the chair. Now, I'm curious, so if this bill becomes law, what are the differences between the way that we're treating these death transfers for boats versus real estate?
So the 2014 Uniform Real Property Transfer on Death Bill created the Transfer on Death Deed, which already allows for the transfer of real property using a deed, which is a very similar mechanism. The specific details of which I'm not entirely familiar with, but the idea with this bill was to make it so that folks that have smaller estates that might have only a few assets could avoid the probate process and not have to hire an attorney to help them transfer their assets. The probate process can take, you know, a couple of years to work its way through as, you know, sort of layers of creditors and responsibilities are addressed in a certain kind, in a certain order, and involves the court system, whereas a transfer on death deed would be just about instant. So you can imagine that in the state of Alaska, you could have a family fishing business where there's a fishing boat that's owned, and you know, if the elder member of the family passes away and the younger person who's been fishing as a part of the family fishing business would like to assume immediate ownership of the boat, that this would make that process much more efficient and they could begin, you know, immediately fishing with full responsibility for the boat immediately.
Let's actually do this because we are coming fast onto the top of the hour, and I would like to get a chance to take public testimony on this. We can come back to questions of the bill sponsor. We're not moving this bill today. So I'm going to go ahead and open public testimony on House Bill 110. And looks like the only person that wants to testify is Jane Andreen, who is here in the room today. Ms. Andreen. She's not here. Well, we will give her an opportunity since she's kind of invited testimony. When we bring the bill back up, we can. Is she nearby? Okay, she seems to be unavailable. I will note that to the extent you had invited testimony, particularly AARP, when we hear the bill again, we'll certainly give her an opportunity to provide invited testimony. I don't see anyone else in the room. I don't see anyone else online that wants to provide testimony on House Bill 110, so we're going to close public testimony. And are there additional questions for the bill sponsor? We've got a few more minutes, and then we have at least one other bit of business. And Mr. Mason? I'm just looking at the clock. We've got seven amendments. I think we probably won't get to House Bill 115 today, but I will plan to bring it up under bills previously heard on Monday.
Comments
or questions? You don't necessarily have to have comments at this point. You're welcome to, but questions or comments as to House Bill 110.
Okay. Well,
Representative Kopp, go ahead.
Yes. So. To the sponsor, Representative Sponholz, I appreciate you bringing this bill forward. As someone who has been involved with probate court, which is never fun, it always means a loved one or a dear friend died and you ended up being executor or something like that. This addresses a major hassle. And as much as this can be set up ahead of time for automatic transfer of spouses, I even think of people being deployed. So we have so many military people in Alaska. If they were set up with a transfer on death, it would save their spouse or loved one a lot of headache. And I, from having to go through that process, I can see where this is introducing some concepts that are much needed in Alaska law. So thanks for bringing it forward to us.
Thank you.
Representative Eastman, question or comment? We're open right
thank
now.
Thank you. Yeah, through the chair. I'm just curious, so how do we make sure and distinguish, and I'm sure you've covered some of it here in the bill, how do we distinguish between someone who is acting in good faith and trying to anticipate a future death and someone who is recognizing that, wow, you know, my relative, my spouse, boy, they've got a lot of debts, and I just want to be able to get the collateral, you know, in under my name or get it moving in that direction so that, you know, they don't end up paying off those debts and I don't get it.
Representative Eastman through the chair. So this this bill does not preclude, it doesn't mean that debts of a person are not resolved. Debts still exist and they'll still have to be dealt with by beneficiaries. It doesn't circumvent that process. One piece of this is that that the any money that's owed, if there is a note, for example, a loan on a vehicle, that loan and that responsibility then transfers to the beneficiary. So you're not able to circumvent financial responsibility by using the transfer on death deed. As far as, you know, nefarious intent, you still have to prove that somebody actually died for the asset to transfer from one person to another. So fraud would still be fraud.
And follow up?
Representative Eastman.
Thank you. So if my my relative, you know, is $1 million in debt and he dies and I say, wow, you know, the truck's going to go to pay off those debts, but I you know, go down to the DMV, I show my death certificate and I say, hey, you should transfer it to me. Now the DMV's not going to know that, you know, they've got this other debt that's not a lien on the vehicle and whatnot. I know it, but I'm probably not going to, you know, if I don't tell the DMV, then they're just going to transfer the title to me, right? And how do we resolve that kind of scenario?
Representative Eastman, through a chair, it might, first of all, I mean, the purpose of the transfer on death deed is to circumvent the probate process, and the idea is to create ease for people that aren't big, you know, that can avoid going through the probate process. There will still be responsibility for, you know, liabilities if your estate has liabilities. I think that to get into the specific details of that question, it might be better if we brought in, you know, somebody from the Department of Law or from the estate planning group of the Alaska Bar Association.
Sure, that'd
which
be great.
I believe is somebody that we can bring in for our next hearing.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Ledoux.
Yeah, I would actually like to talk to somebody from the Bar Association, because it actually is my understanding that if property transfers automatically and the item that is transferred doesn't have a lien on it, then it's not part of the estate. So if the estate owes, oh, let's just say $500,000, and maybe you've got a boat which is worth $500,000, and that boat transfers automatically, and then there's no other assets left in the estate, then it's not a matter of that you have to tell somebody. Even if you told, you know, the vehicle registration people, the person who gets the boat or the person who gets the car simply is not liable for paying estate debts.
Representative Ledoux, through the chair, that is my understanding, with the exception of if there is a debt associated with the boat that's been transferred, the beneficiary would be responsible for that.
So,
follow up.
So,
Representative Ledoux, go
so
ahead.
Is there any cap on the value of what can be transferred automatically? Because that's actually a fairly large policy question, whether we want to let an estate avoid, and the beneficiaries of that estate avoid all of, like, let's say you've got a fishing enterprise, and maybe you own the fishing boat free and clear, but you've got a whole bunch of other debts. And then the fishing boat goes to the spouse who inherits it free and clear and doesn't have to pay any of those debts.
Just a quick question, Representative Ledoux, and this probably goes to the bill sponsor as well. I believe this bill only applies to vessels that are registered with the state, and so your typical fishing boat of any size is actually going to be registered with the Coast Guard, and I believe this bill specifically exempts vessels registered with the Coast Guard, and I think once you differentiate Coast Guard registered vessels with what the state registered vessels, you're hard pressed to find a state registered vessel of the kind of value you're talking about, although the Coast Guard registered vessels, as you and I both know from our days doing maritime law, can be extremely valuable.
I use the boat, Representative Clayman, as kind of an example. In other words, there could be things that are quite valuable that get transferred, leaving the creditors of the estate with nothing to pay them.
So what we're going to do, respond to Representative Ledoux's question that I sort of mucked up the question with the technicality. If you could respond to Representative Ledoux, I think Representative Stutz had a question.
All right. No.
And then you can have one question. Representative Eastman, you can have one question, and then we're going to move on to our last business for the day. Go ahead. Respond to Representative Ledoux.
For the record, Megan Hall and staff to Representative Ivy Sponholz. Representative Ledoux through the chair. First of all, in this bill there is not a cap for value for vehicles and boats that can be transferred upon death. Second of all, there is something that creditors can use to get their debt back, and that is the actual boat or the actual vehicle itself that can be used as collateral. I think it might be helpful to look at sort of a step-by-step process of how it would work. So if there's an estate and someone transfers upon death their car, let's say it's a really expensive, nice Lamborghini, when that is transferred, that car is removed from the probate process. If the individual who died had a lot of debts and the value of their estate, including debts of the car, and the value of their estate wasn't sufficient to satisfy those allowed claims, then the creditors would be able to go to the actual vehicle or boat itself to reclaim the value of that car or to reclaim that debt. I don't know if that clarifies anything, but I hope it does.
I actually am not sure you're correct.
I concur with Representative Ledoux. Representative Stutz, do you have a question? Representative Easton, one last question.
Through the chair. So I know that there are some vehicles out there on the high end that are valued in the millions of dollars. And
they're all in Florida.
Well, maybe they'll move up here. Who knows? But just to get back to what Representative Ledoux was asking. So it seems to me there could be a scenario where we are talking big money, or at least relatively big money. And I'm curious to what extent we might run into some wrinkles with federal law, in that I know that the federal government's gone back as much as 30 years to charge people for payments that were made to relatives. Like, yeah, I remember reading a headline about Medicaid or something. And of course, we've got the IRS to always keep in mind. My concern, and maybe we can address this in a future hearing, is to make sure that we aren't setting up Alaskans to be surprised when they have, you know, title to a vehicle that passes to them, and then the IRS comes knocking on their door someday after the fact, maybe after they've even already sold it, trying to claw back something that was owed from this estate, but by our state law we're taking it as not of the state. I just wonder if the IRS is going to go along with that or if we're going to have some headaches.
Representative Eastman, through the chair, I think that what we need to do probably is to bring in a representative of the estate planning section of the bar or the estate planning council to address some of these specific questions. I think there are valid policy call questions that need to be discussed. The purpose of this bill is not to circumvent responsibility for debts owed. The purpose of the bill is to try to find, you know, a streamlined way for people with modest assets to avoid the probate process. Referencing Representative Ledoux's question from earlier, the, you know, fishing vessels, my understanding per Chair Klayman's statements is that he is correct that fishing vessels tend to be licensed through the Coast Guard, and so what we're primarily talking about are personal use boats, not for commercial fishing purposes. So we're not talking about really high end. However, you could imagine. I mean, we do have some millionaires that live in the state of Alaska that could have a high end yacht. Now, whether that's registered with the Coast Guard or not, I'm not clear, and I think that probably we need to bring in an expert to answer that question. And then if there's a policy call that we want to make as a committee about the value at which we would cap the value of an asset which is eligible for a TOD asset, I think that is perfectly reasonable. But what I don't want to do is, so let's come up with a practical sort of way of addressing those high value assets while allowing people who own, you know, trailers and small boats and vehicles to be able to transfer their assets to their loved ones, without the use of an attorney.
So that gets us to the conclusion of this particular bill. I will make the observation that part of the goal with estate planning has always been plan ahead, and we routinely hear estate planning attorneys saying the smartest thing to do if you have moderate or larger assets is to try to transfer as many of those as possible during your lifetime rather than have them still sitting around after you die. And folks that are actually trying to have security for their loans actually are always well advised to get to secure those loans, which is why those of us with home loans, the banks all have security and position to recover those, which is interestingly enough always secondary to the municipalities claim for taxes. But we're not going to set an amendment deadline in this today. We will bring the bill back up if time allows this session, and if not this session, we will eventually get to it. So we will hold this bill for further review. My aide reminded us, or our committee aide reminded me that I was incorrect when we took up HJR 18, that we actually needed a majority vote of the whole committee to take action on the bill. So I'm going to ask from Representative Stutz a motion to rescind action on HJR 18, and then we'll take it back up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move to rescind action on House Joint Resolution 18, version 31-LS0308/S.
Any opposition? Hearing and seeing none.
Opposed.
There's an opposition to rescinding action. Okay, well, we will then take a vote on rescinding action. Please call the roll about rescinding action on HJR 18.
Well, can I ask a question? So if we rescind action, then we vote again,
yes.
Right? Okay.
Is the objection maintained?
No. Thank you.
So there's no objection. Representative Stutz, can I have a motion for HJR 18?
Certainly, Mr. Chair. I move version 31-LS0308/S of HJR 18 with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
There's an objection by Representative Eastman or Representative Eastman's objection?
No, just Sharon?
Yes.
Just to clarify, this is just to move this out of committee, right?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
Please call the roll.
Representative Stutz?
Yes.
Representative Ledoux?
No.
Representative Wool, not present. Representative Eastman?
No.
Representative Shaw?
No.
Representative Kopp?
Yes.
Chair Klayman?
Yes.
Three yeas and three nays.
So So by a vote of 3-3, HJR 18 has not moved from the committee. We will may have an opportunity at another point to take the bill back up again. But with that, we will adjourn for the day. Our next meeting is on Monday, May 6th at 1 p.m., and with that, we will stand adjourned. It is now 1:09 p.m., or 3:09 p.m.